U.S. policy has perpetrated the crisis and atrocities of the Zionist regime occupation by unconditionally supporting the regime of Israel in three distinct ways: militarily, diplomatically, and politically. On the military front, the United States has so far provided $146 billion in foreign aid, nearly all of it military-related. It currently provides $3.8 billion per year in military aid to the Zionist regime. In addition, the United States is the largest seller of weapons to the Israeli regime, whose military arsenal now includes 362 U.S.-built F-16 warplanes and 100 other U.S. military aircraft, including a growing fleet of the new F-35s, at least 45 Apache attack helicopters, 600 M109 howitzers, and 64 M270 rocket launchers. At this very moment, the Zionist regime is using many of these U.S.-supplied weapons in its devastating bombardment of Gaza. The U.S. military alliance with the Zionist regime also involves joint military exercises and joint production of Arrow missiles and other weapon systems. The U.S. and Israeli regime militaries have collaborated on drone technologies tested by the Israelis in Gaza. The U.S. military also maintains a $108 billion stockpile of weapons at six locations in occupied Palestine, pre-positioned for use in future U.S. wars in the West Asia region. During the Zionist regime assault on Gaza in 2014, even as the U.S. Congress suspended some weapons deliveries to Israel, it approved handing over stocks of 120mm mortar shells and 40mm grenade launcher ammunition from the U.S. stockpile for the Zionist regime to use against Palestinians in Gaza. Diplomatically, the United States has exercised its veto in the UN Security Council 82 times, and 44 of those vetoes have been to shield the Zionist regime from accountability for war crimes or human rights violations. In every single case, the United States has been the lone vote against the resolution, although a few other countries have occasionally abstained. It is only the United States' privileged position as a veto-wielding permanent member of the Security Council and its willingness to abuse that privilege to shield its ally, the Zionist regime, that gives it this unique power to stymie international efforts to hold the regime of Israel accountable for its actions under international law. The result of this unconditional U.S. diplomatic shielding of the Zionist regime has been to encourage increasingly barbaric Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. With the United States blocking any accountability in the Security Council, the Zionist regime has seized ever more Palestinian land in the West Bank and East Al-Quds, uprooted more and more Palestinians from their homes, and responded to the resistance of largely unarmed people with ever-increasing violence, detentions, and restrictions on day-to-day life. Thirdly, on the political front, AIPAC and other pro-Israel lobbying groups have exercised an extraordinary role in bribing and intimidating U.S. politicians to provide unconditional support for the Israeli regime. The roles of campaign contributors and lobbyists in a corrupt U.S. political system make the U.S. uniquely vulnerable to this kind of influence, peddling, and intimidation, whether it is by monopolistic corporations and industry groups like the military-industrial complex and Big Pharma, or well-funded interest groups like the NRA, AIPAC, and, in recent years, lobbies for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. President Joe Biden, who has a long history of supporting Israeli regime crimes, responded to the latest massacre by insisting on Israel's right to defend itself and inanely hoping that this will be closing down sooner than later. His UN ambassador also shamefully blocked a call for ceasefire at the UN Security Council. The silence and words from President Biden and most of representatives in Congress at the massacre of civilians and mass destruction of Gaza is unconscionable. The United States has played a vital and instrumental role in the decades-long catastrophe that has engulfed the people of Palestine.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas, and we promised in the late part of our previous episode about the conditions under which the divorce is deemed valid, would you be able to shed light on all of those conditions and requirements for a valid divorce to take place.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are, of course, a number of conditions which have to be present or met in order for a divorce to be valid.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it is necessary that the husband should pronounce the divorce with his own consent. There should not be any coercion, okay, or any element of compulsion in the divorce, because forced divorce is absolutely invalid. Yes. And of course, if he wants to authorize someone else or deputize someone else,
mm-hmm.
he can do so, but it should be with his permission, okay, with his consent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is number one. And then, of course, the woman who is divorced must be in the state of ritual purity. For example, if a man has had sexual intercourse, he cannot divorce her until that woman is purified from the menstrual blood. Okay,
yes.
He has to wait until the woman gets her monthly period, and after she is purified from the menstrual blood, then he can divorce his wife.
Yes.
Okay, this is number two.
Yes.
And the third condition that has to be fulfilled is the presence of two just witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Just witnesses. Of course, the religious authorities have reiterated and have emphasized on the witnesses being just, being adil, you know. That's very important, because if two people are found, if two people are present, but they are corrupt people, they are evildoers, they are sinners, they are not qualified for witnessing the ceremony or the divorce. Therefore, he must make sure, the husband or his representative must make sure that the people who are present are just. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how do we understand their justice? Or
just people, or people who are just, who are adil, are people who do not commit sins openly. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they follow the Islamic Sharia laws, they abide by Islamic by Sharia laws and values, as they can be seen. Okay. And they do not commit sins openly.
If the two people,
because if they are doing, if they sin, let's say, secretly, we have no information about it.
Because we
do not have knowledge of the unseen, and therefore, to see that they are not, to make sure that they are not sinning or committing sins openly, they do not violate other people's rights, they offer their prayers,
yes,
and they do whatever is obligatory on them, and they stay away from haram things. That's enough, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We are not supposed to go into detail or to do a research,
uh-huh.
Okay? Just like, for example, a prayer leader, when you see that he has beard, he does not sin openly,
mm-hmm.
that's enough, okay? Especially when other people follow him in the prayers.
Should you know those people, like the Friday prayer leader, for example,
yes.
as you said? Sometimes you see that those people who want to say the prayer, they come to the mosque like in a different area of
yeah.
the town, all right? Or they are new or traveler to that town. So they don't know
person. Sure.
This lack of knowledge is enough actually to give the benefit of the doubt that this person is just, and you can, for example, say your prayer behind him, all right? So would that be the case with the just people you're talking about for the divorce to be present there?
Yeah. When someone sees that other mu'mineen or other adherents or practitioners, Muslims, for example, follow that person and consider him as just, it will suffice as an indication
mm-hmm.
to as indication of his being a just person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the same is the case with a person who is supposed to witness a divorce. If someone is praying, if someone does not sin openly,
if they themselves say that they are just, would that suffice it?
And you know, just people usually do not claim to be just, okay? And no one has said, none of the religious authorities have ever said that someone himself should acknowledge or confess that he is just, okay? Justice or injustice can be seen through their actions,
okay,
and through their performances. And of course, it is their performance that suggests whether that individual is just or unjust.
Sorry for the interruption. So would you continue talking about that condition?
Yeah. So this is the third condition, which is the most important condition, of course. And
the justice of the witnesses.
Yeah, the justice of the
two witnesses.
And unlike Ahli Sunnah, who do not consider this last condition as a necessary condition, because according to Ahli Sunnah, if the man or the husband jokingly says, for example, Zawjati Fulan Taliq, okay, my wife with this and so and so name, for example, is divorced, okay, that is sufficient, even if there is no one, and if he says it three times, the divorce occurs. A triple divorce occurs.
Wow.
Know? Yes. And even there are some Sunni scholars who believe that even if a man, for example, is deliriously saying Zawjati Taliq, okay, and he is in a state of delirium, and he is not very much serious.
Yes.
And he says Zawjati Fulan Taliq, then the divorce takes place.
So mental health is not important.
Yeah,
for them.
It's not important according to them, according to us. Let alone the presence of two just witnesses.
Wow.
Okay, but you know the Quran explicitly refers to this condition, and I at this point I do not remember the verse. But if you do a search, you will definitely find the verse, the appropriate verse, which requires the presence of two witnesses in the divorce session.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services: 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions; 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods; 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam; 4. Hajj delegation; 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email: english@sistani.org.
Sheikh Chavit, regarding the first condition you said, you know, we see some people, some couples, in fact, put down some extra or accessory rules. And they note it down, they add it, they put it to their marriage contract or title, all right? For example, as you said, the consent of the husband is necessary as the first, right?
Yeah.
So if they put down that they have equal rights, both couples, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like both husband and the wife. In that case, would that be, according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa, valid? The divorce is
of
valid?
Of course, any condition placed in the marriage contract, if accepted by both parties to the marriage, will be binding, okay?
Yes.
And therefore, if it is a part of the marriage contract, it is included in the marriage contract, and it's accepted by the husband, although it is offered and presented and put forth by the wife.
Yes.
But if it is accepted by the husband, then the wife will have the right to divorce herself on behalf of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, essentially, the wife does not have the right. You know, this right is assigned to her.
It's a secondary, which we call it, a stipulation.
Sure.
Right.
So she can exercise this right to divorce herself, or maybe to choose someone else to divorce her on behalf of her husband.
Okay.
And of course, she can choose a proxy, and in that and that proxy will divorce her according to Islamic Sharia.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures By making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormuz Gun Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of US unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential schools presidential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quiets, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing, and no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide, as defined by the United Nations. I mean, it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel. But former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba, beginning with the Bay of Pigs. They launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against the authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.N. U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade.
Including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela, the U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and the surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
The lies.
In the U.S., creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy efficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artists, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now, and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curvy hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the Inverted Dome. The viewing area of the Inverted Dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
The French artist has created a huge cardboard installation in the shape of the hanging bridge. The artwork is 18 meters in length and hovers above Rome's Tiber River with the help of three gigantic helium-filled balloons. Olivier, who created the work, was inspired by famous Italian Renaissance architect and sculptor Michelangelo. The Italian master had been tasked with the constructing a bridge on Tiber to connect the gardens of the Villa Farnesina to the Farnese Palace. However, he died before he could complete the venture. Now Michelangelo's mission has been accomplished centuries after his demise by one of his admirers. Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. A Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely it's against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in the digital and the nature is it's quite easy to it's merged.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind. Animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 24 goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown bush, and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goat will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Maybe kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male cub was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents. A zoo in central France is welcoming the birth of a male giraffe after 15 months of waiting. The calf is named after Melman, the giraffe character in the Madagascar movie franchise. He was born on Sunday in a Bouval Zoo park. He is 170 centimeters tall and weighs 55 kilograms. Zookeepers say Melman is a special baby.
A giraffe birth here. It's our second birth since we've had the group of females established for a few years. So for us, it's still quite an important and exceptional event because it's not every day that we have a giraffe birth.
The giraffe keepers say Melman stood on his feet for the first time 45 minutes after being born. Since zoos have opened in France, visitors can enjoy seeing little Melman playing around with his mother. The birth of the baby giraffe is good news for wildlife preservation, as according to estimates, the number of the animal in the wild has dropped by about 30% since the 1980s.
The issue of marine trash has long worried scientists and environmentalists. Now a French engineer has invented a robot to help clean ocean waste. The Jellyfish Bot is a remote-controlled, electric-powered boat that helps clean rubbish from the surface of the water. It's 70 centimeters long and 70 wide, almost the size of a suitcase. The robot can collect everything from plastic bottles to masks and even oil and petrol. Despite its wide-ranging utility, Jellyfish Bot has a rather simple mechanism.
To collect trash, you have to do something as simple as possible, because otherwise, if we put too complicated mechanisms, it can get blocked and things can get stuck in the system. We designed the robot with a slide mechanism that goes towards a net, so we fill up the net, we take back the net, and that's the end of it.
The trash collecting robot is being used at around 15 ports in France, lightening the workload of local cleaners. It has also been exported to countries including Japan, Norway, and Singapore. The makers have also developed an autonomous version of the boat.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers, is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic. Funny. A giant 3D cat has risen to fame in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, bringing joy to citizens amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A massive billboard featuring the cat has been installed in one of Tokyo's busiest districts. The realistic-looking cat on a 4K resolution screen appears every few minutes between advertisements. Depending on the time of day, the cat appears differently and sometimes meowing at people walking by. The companies that set up the billboard hope that they can cheer people up during the dark era of the coronavirus pandemic. The display has already caused a frenzy in the city and among the social platforms, with many expressing joy and amazement at the technology.
Peru is full of natural wonders worthy of appreciation in each of its regions. A zoo in the capital, Lima, has now unveiled an incredibly cute and adorable Andean alpaca calf to attract visitors amid dwindling zoo-goers due to the coronavirus pandemic. This fairy baby alpaca named Paquita is just 1 month old and was introduced to the public on the eve of the 200th anniversary of Peru's independence from Spain. The zoo has also displayed its families of llamas, alpaca, and vicuña. The three are members of South American camelids' biological family and are traditionally valued for their soft and warm wool. They live in the Andes Mountains, which lay thousands of meters above sea level. Peruvians are proud of the history of wools associated with these species, which have common ancestors with camels.
IRIB English Radio.